Blog Talk Radio.
Future that lies ahead, one that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At The World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the greatest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Man, doing great. Doing great. Glad we're getting to do the program. We had intended originally to do this last night, and Blog Talk Radio was having some sort of issue, and so glad to get it done.
They had other plans for us last night is the only way to say it. We wanted to do a Sunday night show, and Blog Talk Radio was not cooperating. Our glitch of the night was no show. So, you know, sometimes they're bigger.
Which is rare, you know.
Smaller.
We've had glitches, with Blog Talk Radio, particularly when they were in their beta stage. Which seemed to last a long time, to be honest. But
Aren't they still beta? Are they finally out of beta?
I think they finally come out of beta, I think, in the last 2 or 3 months. But anyway, it was like glitch of the week for a long time there, and it'd been a long time since we had a glitch, but this one cratered the show, and so glad whatever issues they were having, they worked out and to do the show tonight. So that's great.
Yeah. On the other hand, if they're a production system, I think we're owed a refund for last night. I'm going to have to. If anyone from Blog Talk Radio is listening, you can just volunteer that refund to us, or you know, however you want to work that, but. Before we jump into our topic tonight, which is doing everything with nothing, I do want to talk about football a little bit, Stephen, because, you know, we talked about it last week, and then not only did the Broncos win the following week, but, and I can't emphasize this enough, New England lost again, okay? So I feel that, scientifically we've established that. What's that?
A little vindication, or what have we
established? No, I'm just saying scientifically we've established that when we talk about it on the show, it makes the Broncos win and the Patriots lose. So I feel that it's important.
Well, maybe we should just talk about them every week, and they'll be
that almost deserves a Tales of the Paranormal theme, I think. But I'm pretty sure that based on last week's solid evidence that that's the only conclusion you could draw. We talked about it, and then that happened. So I don't know why I would even mention this, because obviously people who live in the Northeast and people from Boston and people who follow the Patriots are some of the nicest and most wonderful people in the world. Wouldn't you agree? I think that that's true. But ESPN did this thing last week. I don't know if you saw it. It talked about who are the biggest crybaby NFL fans.
Okay,
I shouldn't even talk about it. Never mind. You know what? I'm sorry I brought it up. I don't think we should talk about it, come to think of it. I want to go back to what I said before, which is what a great bunch of people from New England are. And I think that's right? What else would I'm not going to.
These guys are great. We love them.
Yeah. I got nothing else to say. Yeah.
Okay.
That covers it for football. Oh, Broncos won. Okay. And, go Broncos. So that's football. Great. Anything big going on in your world this week, Stephen?
Oh no! My oldest son is. It looks like he's finishing up his first semester in college. We're very proud of him. He's doing so well, and And so it would be good to have him home here in about a week or so.
He must be in finals now, right? Or is he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is he's in the home stretch now. So go, Timothy. So
good luck, Timothy.
Yeah.
Get on home. Christmas vacation awaits. So just
that's right.
A few more
that's
days.
Right.
I imagine just it must be real close now, huh?
Yeah, yeah. We he's this is sort of we're kind of in the middle here of our beginning of dead week, and then next week is finals. So
oh, okay, there you go. Oh, okay.
Wrap that. It'll wrap it up for him the next week and a half. Basically, it'll get it done for him.
All right, study hard, Timothy. We're counting on you. All right. Well, in that case, we'll move on to I think a topic that's of great value to him and to everyone who's working on taking tests or trying to complete any difficult task, and that is, I think, my favorite topic on this show. I'm going to say if I'm going to pick a favorite topic, this is it, ephemeralization, and we're going to talk about that tonight, doing everything with nothing, ephemeralization and the future of the future, I call this. So one good thing that happened last night, Stephen, from the show being postponed was I improved the title. Did you notice that the title's a little better now?
Yes, you did.
Yeah,
and I corrected your spelling on weird, but no, that's just no.
Thank you.
Neither here nor. You know, and the way I did it, you know, on the DL, so no one would know. You know,
thanks.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that would be embarrassing if people found out about that. So I appreciate you keeping it. Keeping it just between us, huh? That's
yeah, that's right. We're just me, you, and the audience. So
now, of course, I don't misspell words. That's what's called a typographical error.
Yeah, that's a typo there. That's what that was.
In the industry.
Yeah, but how precisely did you change the title of the show? What exactly did you do here?
Well, before I believe it was called "The Ephemeral Future Is Here" or "Upon Us" or something like that, and it didn't have the word ephemeralization in it, which I think is important, an important concept, ephemeralization, not just ephemeral, which is a great word, by the way, and not that hard to spell. But ephemeralization is actually the concept that's associated with R. Buckminster Fuller, our patron saint here of this topic, who said that in the future technology is going to allow us to do more and more with less and less until eventually you can do everything with nothing. And I don't know if you've ever read the essay that concept is taken from, but the technology that he uses to explain that is not what you would expect. We always talk in terms of digitization, and I do want to talk about things going digital because I think that's a huge part of the world becoming ephemeralized. But his example actually had to do with how you build an arch and how you build a bridge. And he takes it from the most kind of crude and heavy and rock-intensive way to do it that the ancients originally did to this beautiful, masterworks that the Romans finally came up with, you know, where it's almost like magic how the whole thing holds together. And there's just this one rock in the middle, this one stone in the middle, this I can't think of the word for that, that's holding everything together, right?
Keystone.
And then how that principle got, you know, expanded on even further to suspension bridges, and ultimately you have this really interesting situation if you look at the history of bridges, where you go from these huge piles of rocks to these very tenuous steel and cable structures, you know, that weigh a few percentage points of what the original would have weighed to cover the same amount of distance, right? But that are much more reliable and that hold much greater mass. So he, you know, as he was wont to do, he used an engineering principle from, you know, he used a design principle from engineering, right? He was an architect and construction to explain this principle. But then he would go on and talk about all the ramifications that this basic principle has, and it is a fundamental principle that drives progress. It's a fundamental principle that drives all the good stuff. Is it true? All the good stuff? Most of the good stuff that we talk about on this show. It's a big part of it. The idea that you can get better, you can get ultimately better net results, but initially the same net results from something that's smaller, more compact, lighter, or from less effort, or, you know, from generally less stuff. The idea of over time, we get the same results without having to put the same inputs in. I guess that's the highest level of abstraction that you can grant to that, Stephen, unless you can take it up another notch.
Well, I'm just thinking that he would be very impressed with seeing some of the structures that are built within virtual environments these days, including
oh, yeah.
the arch. You know, you know, imagine a suspension bridge built in a virtual world. You know, in employing all the same techniques that Buckminster Fuller would have been very at home with, but in a completely virtual environment, doing everything with nothing. Okay.
Right.
I think he would say yes. This is the culmination of what I was talking about. Maybe in a way I didn't perceive, but yes, this is it. This is everything with nothing. So, I think that that's what I think that's. He would say that yes, it's just got it gets more and more that way, and until you know you have a virtual environment. So.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's the direction he's going, doing everything with nothing, is, you know, it sounded fanciful when he said it, but once digital technology really took hold, it didn't sound quite as crazy, because you get so much leverage when things are digitized, and we're actually on the I had some links set up, and I don't have them out now, so I'll just talk through it, but I was going to talk about Nicholas Negroponte and his book, Being Digital, which I think we're at like the, is it possible the 30th anniversary of that book, 25th anniversary? It's been a few years now. But
wow.
Seminal, important book about a lot of the things that we're talking about right now. He could see some big stuff coming. You know, one of the really interesting things he talked about in that book, I was reading about this last night getting ready for the show, that I'd forgotten about, is he talked about we're doing phones and TV backwards. So it must have been more than 30 years ago. He said, you know, we're doing phones over wires and we're doing TV over the air, and eventually we're going to switch those. And he was exactly right. You know, that is exactly what happened. And he said, you know, it makes sense that the infrastructure for television would be cable, especially because, and he talked about, you know, all the possibilities for interactive content and all that kind of thing, but also just the fact that you got this, you know, this pipeline, this,
you know,
channel of data going into your house.
It's interesting you should say that, Phil, because, you know, one of the first things we did when we reclaimed, bandwidth, basically, from the airwaves after going digital with broadcast signals, they said, okay, we're going to reapply that to cellular.
Yep,
and that's what they did, because we needed the additional additional bandwidth for cell phones. One of the reasons we had to go digital with TV.
So you know it's all kind of connected that way when you look at it. But
yeah.
But he took it a lot further. I mean, obviously he was looking at computer technology, and he was looking at the digitization of media and of ultimately experience. And it's very interesting in the book. He talks about the relationship between atoms and bits. Atoms
yeah.
are the fundamental building blocks of the quote-unquote real world, the solid, substantial real world, the meat space world that we live in. And bits, of course, are the fundamental building block. They're the atoms of the digital world. And there's this trade-off, this amazing kind of evolution that's occurring where when possible, atoms are being replaced by bits. Anytime you can do something with bits rather than atoms, you're way better off, because it's so much easier to manipulate them, to move them around, to transform them into something else. You just come out way ahead in the deal. And when we talk about things like the we've talked about those pictures that show, you know, in 1979, here's all these devices, and then in, you know, 2010 and
yeah,
on, right? You got
the
iPhone,
yeah.
Right? Yeah. and what's going on there is a whole bunch of atoms got replaced by bits, right? So you end up with just a few atoms, you know, relatively speaking. I mean, obviously there's still trillions of atoms to make up an iPhone, but just a little bit of matter and a whole lot of data. And that's the the basic transformation that he's talking about in that book. This evolution, as I like to say, from a world made out of stuff to a world made out of data. And that is one of the primary fundamental drivers of ephemeralization. But they're not exactly the same thing. And that's why I wanted to point out that Fuller didn't start talking about going digital. He started in engineering and talked about how you build a bridge. And our examples this evening that we're going to use aren't all about being digital. In fact, I think maybe only one or two of them really have to do with digitizing in a big way, and the others have to do with other ways that things can be ephemeralized, where other ways that you can reduce the load, reduce the amount of matter or the amount of energy required to do something, and still get the same result, or in fact still get a better result. And in fact,
one of the drivers, Phil, in addition to ephemeralization, is decentralization. Taking things from a central place and being able to farm that out to the world, basically. And it's what I called coffee shopification in my article way back when. It's and our first story tonight is about really the coffee shopification of energy, using solar to decentralize the production of power, and that's our first story tonight. It's an article from Bloomberg, the Silicon Valley idea that's driving solar use worldwide, not just here in the United States, but in particular in China. They're attempting to duplicate something that's being done. Really was started in Silicon Valley, right?
And so it's great when you hear that, when you say, oh, the idea, there's some new technology, there's some new concept that's making solar more widespread. So I'm thinking, oh, a breakthrough in photovoltaics, or maybe some new manufacturing process that makes it easier to produce solar cells, or wait, I don't know, some kind of new app that lets people share solar cells in some complex Internet of Things kind of way. Is it some big technological thing like that? Is that right, Stephen? Is that the big...
It's not that at all. It's not that at all. You know, like...
What's going on?
Well, you know how we point to things that change the world, like the inventing of the printing press. We also point to things like double-entry bookkeeping, okay?
Right.
That was a killer app that changed the world. It created the possibility for the Western world to just explode. This is something here too. There's the use of leasing of solar powered equipment. In other words, you don't own the solar cells that they put on top of your home. The company that puts it on top of your home, they maintain ownership of that. And what you're doing is you're buying power from them, even though the solar cells are on top of your roof. What it creates is an opportunity for people who couldn't afford, $20,000 or $30,000 to put solar cells on top of their home. They can just have somebody come in and install it and immediately start using solar power in their home, often for less than what the power from the grid would be. And so that is a driver for solar power. And China in particular is very interested in this for obvious reasons. You know, you look at the pictures of the smog enveloping many of their cities. You can see why they would be very interested in the use of solar. And they're saying, okay, maybe our people can't afford to put it on top of their roof, the roof of their home. But here, if we use something similar to this, where a company, maintains ownership of that, installs it, and then sells them the power. So basically, they're renting the roof space, and then selling them power that's generated right there at their home.
So the big breakthrough that's driving the world to solar, that's really making solar take off, is instead of people buying their own cells, they're renting them. I mean, right? That's
right.
What it comes down to. It's astounding. I remember we've talked about this idea before a few years ago. There's a great chart in the Bloomberg story that shows home solar leases, the progression in how many megawatts are being produced over the last few years, and you can really see this spike that's occurring based on the fact that people are starting to lease their cells. And I remember we talked about this a few years ago, and one of the objections that gets raised to this by some is that, oh, well, this is all subsidized, right? When you say it's a lease,
yeah.
What you're saying is it's all subsidized. Well, there's two responses to that. First is, anything that's rented or leased is subsidized. It's true. You know, if you've ever heard of like Rent-A-Center, where people rent their own furniture and stuff, that's right. That company is subsidizing the purchase of the furniture, and they're making it up on the back end through the through the rental. So in fact, all forms of rental are involve subsidies. There's no getting around it. But I think the mistake that people make is thinking that subsidy means government subsidy, which in this case, sometimes it will mean that and sometimes it won't. In China, yeah, it's probably going to mean that, right? And in the U.S., depending on who's putting it in place, there's probably going to be some kind of kickback thing going on with the local utility. But when you look at how fast this thing is taking off, this is an actual, you know, economic growth that business is interested in, right? This is actual money, right, to be made.
I mean, look at the chart, Phil. I mean, when we started this program back in 2005, 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
okay,
mm-hmm.
according to this chart, rooftop solar was basically zero.
Yeah.
In 2005. And now in the United States, rooftop solar represents 130 megawatts, which, you know, it's looks like it's on track to basically double every year. At least it has since what, about 2008?
Yep. It's a 16-fold increase since 2008. So that's 7 years. So
yeah.
Hard math, but yeah, I think it's doubling. I think you're right about every year. And that's what exactly what Ray Kurzweil would say is happening.
Told us years ago
it was going to happen.
Yeah, and so that is remarkable. But you know what? I've got an idea, and I'm going to just throw this out. If any Solar City exec happens to be listening to this program, here's my idea. And these guys are smart. They probably already thought of this, but let me throw this out. Let's further ephemeralize. I'm having trouble with the word there, Phil. But anyway,
you got it. You nailed it. That's it. Ephemeralize.
Okay.
Yep.
Let's go one step further. What about the people that don't have roof space? People in apartments. Why couldn't they buy power from SolarCity? You know, I want to do my part. I'm living in an apartment in some place, and I want to do my part in encouraging solar. And I want to think to myself, you know what, I'm buying solar. And so I contact SolarCity, and they say, well, do you have a roof? No, I don't. What do I do? Well, SolarCity could say, you know what, that's okay. We own 10,000 acres, out in Arizona somewhere. What you're buying from us is credit for a certain amount of solar that we're putting into the grid. And by doing so, you are buying it from us, and therefore we will subsidize, or we will pay for part of your electric bill, basically. Why couldn't they do that? Is what I'm saying making sense?
Absolutely. You got a virtual rooftop out in the desert for everybody who doesn't have a roof.
That's right.
Right? Yeah.
Right.
I think it's a fantastic idea.
Now the customer that actually has a roof that they're allowing panels to be put on, maybe they deserve a better deal. But everybody ought to be able to participate in this. And I'm hopeful that SolarCity or some company will say, yeah, we're just we'll add another few panels out there in the desert, and you send us a check, and we'll help pay your electric bill every month.
I think that's a great idea, Stephen. That's like a world transformed idea right there. You should get these guys on the phone. Surely people are talking about doing something like this. I'm kind of excited about this idea. it's the next logical step from doing it on your own roof, right?
I suspect they've already thought about this, but there's nothing about that in the article here at Bloomberg. So maybe they haven't, but that's the next logical step. You don't even need roof space to participate in the solar revolution with that idea.
Absolutely. All you need to do is be a consumer of energy. If you're a consumer of energy, you can subscribe to this model, and you become part of the solution. It's a great idea. I think that what you see in that chart, when I look at that, is, I mean, that's almost a hockey stick, right? If you look at that curve to 2020, at the rate it's going, that's going to be going just almost straight up, isn't it?
And this got to be a good. This got to be good news for everybody, Phil. I mean, this is clean power. This is we're not burning fossil fuel for this power. And I mean, we're not even killing birds with giant windmills. Right?
Yeah,
this is just good. There's no downside to solar at all, and so. The fact that this is just really taking off the way it is encouraging.
Well, you know, I got to say, whenever Ray Kurzweil talks about energy, the future of energy, he always talks about solar.
Yeah, he never says anything about wind or, you know, tidal power. He really believes that solar is it, or he seems to, because that's what he really focuses on.
And when you look at this chart, you go, oh, okay, well, it's because he loves these exponential charts. But it's like, okay, yeah, but the reason he loves these exponential charts is because they're the things that change everything, right? They're the things that drive everything and change everything. And I don't think you can find a curve like this for any other energy source currently. I mean, you can't find a curve like this for much of anything in the world.
As much as I admire nuclear, there's not a curve like this for nuclear, you know?
Right, yeah. Not to say there might not be at some point, but right now, smart money's on solar for being just a hugely transformational technology for us, because it's already ramping itself up. I mean, it's making the move, and I think that line will go straight. I think we'll see it go even straighter than it's going. We're going to see a true beautiful exponential curve, just like we've seen applied to information technologies of various kinds over the years. We're seeing it happening with an energy technology. I think that's quite exciting. And it's all happening because of leasing the equipment. That's the amazing thing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Just to get back to our principle of ephemeralization, all you had to do was change who owns it, and suddenly the whole thing takes off. Now, Ray would probably argue that there's a lot going on with photovoltaics and a lot of other things. There's a lot of drivers here, but this is a big one. And I'll tell you, that chart makes a big deal out of the fact that Solar City Home Lease debuted in 2008, and you know, it wasn't long after that that the line really started going vertical, was it?
That's right, and it had to be part of it. It had to be part of it. But go back to what Ray's looking at it, how effective these solar panels are becoming, you know, more and more all the time. You know, Solar City wouldn't be able to do what they're doing, obviously, if they weren't seeing the numbers. You know, if they were crunching the numbers and weren't coming out with a way to make a living out of doing this, then they wouldn't have done it. But it required a certain level of power being generated based on the amount of investment they put in, and so that was important to them too. But individuals wouldn't be putting solar on their rooftops without something like Solar City coming in and saying, you know what, you don't have to, you know, lay down the $20,000 or $30,000. We got this, you know.
Right.
You just buy the energy from us as if we were your electric company, and we'll sell it to you cheaper, and you can feel good about this because, hey, you know, your carbon footprint just got divided in half, basically.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, going back to what I said before, if when you see a growth curve like this, it really doesn't matter what model is being used or who has a finger in the fire or what. You know, there is value being generated here. There's no way it's not. You know, so and to your point, everybody's coming out ahead. So great stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so. We've got several more of these, and I realize we're we're spending a lot of time on solar, but that's just such a fun one. Okay, let me take the next one. This was over on IFL Science. I like how they've abbreviated their name so that you can talk about it with your mom. You know, it's now IFL Science. I think that's good. Scientists find way to deactivate most common cancer-causing protein. Now, this is really interesting because you can look at this story as ephemeralization a couple of ways. Is it a story of information technology? Well, not exactly. In some ways, it's more like Buckminster Fuller and redesigning the bridge, right? But
right.
When you think about how we go about treating cancer, you know, how is cancer tackled? Well, there are two great approaches. One is to try to prevent it in the first place. So you do diet and lifestyle and all that kind of stuff. And the other thing is you've got cancer and then you have to treat it. And there's these huge interventions that have to be performed. You go in and you surgically remove a tumor and or you flood the body with poison called chemotherapy or you flood the body with deadly radiation to kill those growing cancer cells. Not to say anything bad about any of those techniques. They're the best we've had up to this point, and they do what they do. They've got their upside and they got their downside. I think their drawbacks have been discussed ad nauseum, even by us, right? We've talked about this. But what if there's a different way of fighting cancer? And we talk about, nanotech. You send little robots in, and they'll take out the cancer cells one by one. It's like, well, okay, that's good too. But you know what? You've already got cancer. By the time that occurs. So it's like, oh, well, prevention. So you've got, what's going on? How are you going to prevent cancer from coming? Well, this is what they've come up with. This is a team of researchers in Toronto, and they have found a way to inhibit the development of cancer through the protein that is most responsible for the formation of the tumors. And what's interesting about this and what turns this into almost an information technology thing is that what this protein does is it facilitates the communication between the cells delivering signals. So you're looking at like growth factor receptors and the, what's happening with the nucleus that contains the DNA. So essentially, these proteins are the communications infrastructure that enables cancer to grow. And what a great way to fight cancer, right? Rather than, trying to prevent it in the first place, which obviously we would still want to do, or trying to kill it once it's already here, it's like you're just jamming the signal, basically. Go ahead.
I would say, Phil, that let's take the metaphor completely out of it. It is an information technology. It's not essentially this way. It is this. I mean. The way I think that we ultimately cure cancer or kill, or at least get ahead of cancer in this fight is battle it with information technology, because that's what it is. I mean, life is an information technology, and cancer is a computer virus inside of our bodies, we need to, we need to attack it as such. So there's information. Being able to attack it in this way, attack this particular protein, it's entirely an information technology situation. It's exciting.
I agree. I don't disagree with you. The only reason I don't put it thoroughly in that camp is that we're not going in and writing the code, right? All we're doing is an organic solution that takes out the protein, right? If we were actually going in and I'm sorry.
A little later in the show, we got like two or three stories from now. I think I'm pulling that story on up, and we'll talk about it next if that's okay.
But we're going there. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the ultimate direction.
We're absolutely
you're right.
going. Yeah.
Yeah. This one is more like you go in and what do? It's like the enemy's transmitting signals. You just go blow up their radio tower, right? That's what this one is. What we're going to talk about in a minute is more subtle. It's like you get in there and you start sending your own signals, right? I mean, it's like
exactly.
Yeah, you send out your own propaganda over their channel. Go ahead.
If it's okay, I would go ahead then and pull that story from the end of the show to right now. Human gene editing research should proceed, concludes historic tech summit. And it goes into describing a flexible new gene editing technique known as CRISPR. Now, CRISPR basically comes down to this. It is a tool by which we can edit the genome of anything, Phil. And the limits to this there just really doesn't seem to be a whole lot of limit to this. If there's disease that is a genetic disease, you could solve it with this sort of technique. I think you could attack cancer with this sort of technique. It's remarkable what CRISPR will allow us to do. You had put something on Facebook the other day that I thought about when I was reading the story. Would outlawing the human genetic alteration or whatever, could that potentially kill you? And yes, it could. We need to be able to do these things because ultimately we all, in our old age at least, we fight cancer and we fight all kinds of problems that are associated with aging. CRISPR could be a solution to these things.
You know, the amazing thing about CRISPR, when you talk about an information technology, in this story, this is actually a news story or maybe an editorial over on Reason.com. Talking about this,
yeah.
But the metaphor they use is a word processing program. Basically, you're going in and editing genetic code the way you would go into Microsoft Word and edit a memo that you had written at work or, whatever. Basically, you're just clipping things, you're moving things around, you're getting things into the right order, or really a text editor that a computer programmer uses is an even better metaphor, right? Because ultimately, this is what you're creating is a program that you can run. We know we're all running these programs all the time. That's what life is, basically, is a series of these computer programs running in our in the molecules in our body. And this ability is limited right now, really, I'm going to say, by two things. And tell me if I've got the list right here. First, effective knowledge of the code, right? It's like we can go in and make any change we want, but we don't know really yet, in most cases, what are the big changes we can make, right? What moving one thing is necessarily going to do, right? So there's a huge amount that has yet to be learned there. There are some things that we do know, and we can go in and make those changes, but this is largely an area that still has to be figured out. And then two, and this is the part I'm never quite clear on, is just dissemination of it, right? So,
right.
If I'm gonna rewrite my genetic code, if you change it in a few cells, does it replicate? How does that part actually take place? I've never been clear on that, but is that covered here? I have to admit, I haven't read the whole piece.
Well, that's called germline genetic engineering. There's a difference between that and genetic engineering. Let's say as an adult, I've got a genetic disease, let's say. And there are ways that you could, have gene therapy to correct that genetic disease without affecting the germline so that I would pass on that correction to the next generation, okay? You could just fix it for me and not fix it for the, for subsequent generations. And so
right.
there's a lot of concern about germline genetic engineering. You're at that point you are affecting the world basically. And ultimately, right? Because if it gets into the gene pool, it's out there, right? So
right.
There's a lot of concern about that, but it's they don't really get into that in this story, but what I found was remarkable is the level of excitement among the scientists. Often scientists are like the last people to be excited about the very thing that they're, the very possibilities they're talking about. But Not so much here. This is interesting. Everything is possible with CRISPR. The Baylor geneticist Hugo Bellin told Science News this week. I'm not kidding, he says. Researchers hope that will allow them to cure cancer, correct genetic disease, generate more productive and nutritious crops and farm animals, spread desired genetic modifications through wild ecosystems. Now, that's germline, spread desired genetic modifications through the wild ecosystem, and that concerns a lot of people, and I think it should. Engineer pigs as organ donors for people. In other words, you'd be putting in human, human DNA into the pigs so that they could grow human organs, and prevent heritable diseases by altering the genomes of human embryos. All in the not so distant future, everything is possible with CRISPR. So that's remarkable how much would be possible, and how excited the people that are at the cutting edge of this are about the possibilities here.
And this is something where I think we've talked about this before. The big progress will occur initially, probably in treating existing conditions, curing illnesses, right? But
right.
The possibility is there to do all the rest of it, right? It's, on the one hand, make modifications that aren't curing diseases, but that are just simply, giving people better vision or, better mental acuity or whatever it would be.
The argument would be, well, why would, if we can put that in the germline, why wouldn't we, right?
I mean, yeah, modifying
if,
the species, right?
If subsequent generations all have better than 20/20 vision and everybody's got, 150 IQ, why isn't that a good thing? Well, the problem would be that we would tend towards one view of perfection, and a lot of the variation within the human race might be lost, and that I'm not sure that that's completely a good thing. And so we would definitely want to preserve if we were going to start tinkering with the germline, we would definitely want to preserve the way the germline is now, so that if we find that we've made a mistake here, we could go back and correct it back.
Want a backup. You always got to have a
backup. You want a backup. Yeah, that's right. If there's a problem with your computer, you always want to be able to go back to the particular date where there wasn't a problem, right? Reinstall back to before you did something to screw it all up, right?
So. Right. Yeah, although I think ultimately the concern about variety would, I don't think it would be a big issue, because it's the difference between development and evolution. I remember John Smart talking to us about this years ago, where we're going to move towards certain developmental optima, stereo vision, hearing, being bipeds. These are these things that were just they were maximally useful configurations to end up with. So we went there, right? I'm thinking that things like, better than 20/20 vision, 150 IQ, those would all be almost in the developmental optima category. But the evolution side, right, all the variations, all the blue eyes, green eyes, now purple eyes, left eye one color, right eye the other color, people are going to, they're going to be free to do whatever they want to with that. And you bring human creativity into that. Yes, that also is potentially very scary, but it creates tremendous diversity, right? More than nature probably could have ever provided, ultimately. The risk of people doing, I suppose, crazy things with their genes is the only fear there.
Yeah. Basically, you could go the other way to the point that it would be scary too. I mean, fracturing of the human race into multiple subcategories, that would be potentially possible with CRISPR too.
Exactly. Yeah. Although, who knows what the groups would be? It's kind of, interesting to imagine, but scary at the same time. Yeah. When there's multiple human species existing at the same time, how do they get along with each other? And what does that say about the future of each of them, right?
Yeah, there was a time when this planet harbored multiple human species, and we don't anymore. So that could tell you something about how well they got along the first time. So, I don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's definitely risks there. But to swing it all back, what this all speaks to is the tremendous capability we have related to our own genetics, owing to the fact that it's an information technology now. And I think to even swing it back to the original story, the one about cancer through the protein, it's the same principle, right? That one is—it's amazing how powerful that is, because that protein is at work in. I'm not sure if it's all cancers, but it's like most cancers, many cancers. And it's like, if you can get that right, if you can blow up that radio tower, you're going to do tremendous things around shutting cancer down. Anyway, now with CRISPR, we can go in and say, well, you know what? These three proteins here actually are what give people the proclivity to get cancer in the first place. We'll just take that out, right? People aren't going to get cancer anymore. So the two things actually go together very well, and they're both really good examples of gaining fantastic leverage over the situation by doing less, right? Rather than going in and performing this huge macroscopic surgery. You just take out one.
How many shows in a row, Phil, have we done where there was some new breakthrough that could possibly be the cure for cancer?
I'd have to count, but I'm thinking this is the fourth or fifth, right?
In a row. Four or five weeks in a row. Now, maybe half of these will come to nothing, right?
Right.
But ultimately, there's this huge weight of discovery that's taking place that, has to be encouraging regarding our fight against cancer. It's just we're learning so much, and we're attacking cancer in, 15, 20 different directions. My money, my bet is now on the human race rather than cancer. It's just
I think so. I think the smart money's on us against cancer. Cancer was looking pretty tough a few decades ago, but by golly, we have swung back. It's all about the fourth quarter in this game, and we are coming on strong.
It looks like
completely. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. We've got a few minutes left, and we've still got two of these to talk about. Our next topic is I called it cutting costs on going to Mars, and this one swings it back around to actually a very similar principle to leasing solar power. This is a story about how do we get to Mars? This is a big project, and we've talked about how over time great capabilities have passed from large nation states down to corporations, and eventually they're going to end up in the hands of individuals. But big space programs, sending people to other bodies in the solar system, so far have been governments, right? Either people or landing things on other bodies. Now we've got the Lunar X Prize, and we've definitely got privatized people going into space. We talk about that all the time, but I don't think there are currently any private plans to put people on the moon, are there?
No, there's things like there's a Google Prize for putting probes on the moon, but not people.
Yeah, I know there's stuff, but nobody's really got a program to create a moon colony or space colony privately. So there's part of this that still belongs to the big nation states. And what's interesting about this piece, this is over on Bloomberg, talking about going to Mars, which even today, in the second decade of the 21st century, is a pretty daunting thing to take on, a pretty big project, even for a country that went to the moon 40, 50 years ago. It's big because it's so far, because there are so many variables, because we know more now than we used to know. There's so many reasons why going to Mars is an exponentially larger task than going to the moon was. So how do you do it? How do you make it happen? Well, you could wait a few more generations and, you know, technology will eventually see to it that every Joe can go to Mars anytime they want to, or you can, you know, find a way to do it now. And how are we going to do it now? Well, NASA's saying, hey, maybe we can do a collective project among nation states. So this is, in fact, almost kind of a regressive step compared to the process that we normally talk about. But it's a way to do more with less, right? Each individual country won't be putting out the same kind of effort that, say, the U.S. was in doing Apollo, right? Because I don't think we'll ever see the period where those kinds of resources get devoted again, right, in a just a gross national product basis.
Yeah,
but,
as a percentage of our gross national product, no.
Yeah. But everybody kicks some in, and voila, you got a Mars mission. So, I mean, that's the basic idea. What do you think, Stephen? You think that's got any legs?
Yeah, I think that there's a possibility of that. When we originally went to the moon, what was the statement we made? We came for humanity, right?
Well, came in peace for all mankind. Yep.
For all mankind. Thank you. And yep. We say that, you know, in one side of our mouth, but in the other side of our mouth is, ha ha, we beat you Russians. I mean, that's
here's our flag. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's our flag, and you know, we came for the United States. It's, that's. And that was true. But I think if we actually make it, you know, if we go to Mars, particularly if it's a big NASA trip, I think that the possibility of, you know, getting Russia involved, getting China involved, and other countries like India
yep.
is coming on strong too in space. So in Japan. You get all these folks involved, you up your chance of being able to do it sooner. From the point of view of you got more people writing checks, you know, and so because it's a huge expensive project.
You know, the analogy that occurred to me when I was thinking about this is like when you move, right? Do you want to do it yourself or no? You get like four or five friends to help, right? And suddenly
that's right.
You know, the project just becomes that much more doable. You know, it's like, well, you got two people handling the couch, right? Rather than one
you
person.
You always call the friends with pickup trucks, right?
Yeah.
So that's what we'll do.
That's why you always need friends to have those. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't just call any country. You call the ones that have, you know, the ability to actually throw in, right? So
they got rockets, or they got the technology, or they got the money, right?
A whole lot of smart people, you know, or whatever, you know, they got something they can throw in on the project. So, yeah, I think that's why.
Yeah, in some ways, this is the best way to ephemeralize, right? Because this is kind of the social principle. I mean, it's social among nations at this point, but it's the same kind of idea that when you create a network, you get all these benefits that you didn't get when you just had one node, right? When you just had one effort to do something. But now suddenly in the interplay between different parties, not only I think would it be more efficient, I think it would probably be a lot more effective, right? Because everybody would be good at something. Everybody would bring something to the table. There'd be this really interesting dialogue, this really interesting conversation going on about how to get to Mars. And ultimately, I think you would have a better project than you probably would have been able to have by having just one group do it. So I look forward to seeing what comes of this. If we go to Mars as a, you know, as a NASA thing, to your point, Stephen, because there are other alternatives for how we might get there, this is feeling like a good one. I like the cut of its jib. So
I'm quite frankly such a cooperative effort. I don't think would be possible without ephemeralization. You have to have a tight network so that people can communicate in real time, you know, across the entire world. And that's part of what the internet has brought to us, and the ability to collaborate with other people throughout the world. And that's part of what would be required for such a huge project.
Absolutely. All right, let's talk about our virtual reality future is bigger than it appears. That's our final one. This is kind of the ultimate in ephemeralization, Stephen. So what's going on with virtual reality?
Well, first, let me just say our link here is dated for whatever reason. Financial Times is, you know, if you hit that link, you go straight to the Financial Times homepage, and even searching
we will
for
get
this
that
article.
Fixed.
Yeah, we're going to get that fixed. But anyway, virtual reality, bigger than it appears. Jonathan Margolis comes back and says, you know what, an article I published a little while ago understated how awesome this is. This, you know, we have come so far in virtual reality, and most people don't understand that because they haven't seen the cutting edge like I have. And he describes, for one of the things that he did, jacked in with the Oculus Rift and everything, and they put in a program where he got to experience the Wright brothers, the flight at Kitty Hawk, and he says it's photorealistic. He said that he felt the wind on his face. Now there's no. You know, there's no fans blowing at him or anything.
Right. There's no haptic interface making you feel
things. No, nothing at all like that. And the guys laughed that he was talking to and telling them that. He says, yeah, that's common. Everybody seems to feel that because the brain kind of fills in the gaps on it. It's so close that to actually being there and seeing the first flight at Kitty Hawk. He says, you know, it was very educational. I had no idea it was right on the beach. I thought it was, you know, out in the desert or someplace. It was, you know, it's on the beach there in North Carolina where this occurred. The ocean is right there. He didn't know that from the pictures, you know, that you see of the flight. And he said the experience of being there was incredible, and it's much. It's come so much further than people realize. He there's a quote here: universities are pouring millions into this. Seriously, this is going to change everything, says the vice president of AMD, Roy Taylor.
What's really interesting about this is, as you read this, is that side of it, because there's two big sides of virtual reality, and one is the entertainment business, and it's interesting what he says about that, you know, because people in the entertainment side of the world are very interested in this technology, and they're looking at, you know, what impact is it going to have, how are we going to do this, and it is different from going to a movie. You know, will we all go to the same, you know, VR station and have a virtual experience together? Probably not, right? It's probably more
probably.
Distributed,
yeah.
And it's more like, you know, playing with your Xbox or something like that. It's more like something that you do individually. So it speaks to kind of this whole new emergent entertainment phenomenon. But when you look at education, when you look at, you know, real simple things like training, and we've talked about medicine, actually any experience that a person can have where they have to overcome distance or cost, or you have to assemble something. I mean, it's a real dumb example, but think how much trouble you would have to go to if you wanted to, in real life, recreate the whole Kitty Hawk experience, right? Compared to putting the Oculus Rift on your head and just there you are, and you're doing it. I mean, this is the ultimate in ephemeralization. That one's a weird example because it's close to entertainment. It's somewhere in between entertainment and education. But you think about the amount of infrastructure that has to go into any educational experience, to learning how to operate a piece of equipment or learning how to do anything or experiencing anything. And suddenly the cost of that drops to the cost of somebody writing software, right? Which is still expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not to say there's not an expense there, but the difference is phenomenal, especially because we know about the tremendous economies of scale that we enjoy with computer technology. And, yeah, everything is going to change, and everything is going to change huge because of virtual reality.
Well, and it's not just entertainment. I mean, I think many, many of us will end up working in virtual reality. I mean, whether it be somebody.
Yeah, any experience. Absolutely. I agree. Yeah.
You know, remote surgery for a surgeon, you know, it could be teaching a class, and the class is distributed throughout the internet, but you all have the experience of being right there in the same classroom. Whatever it is, I think that a virtual reality can contribute to this to ephemeralization. You know, it's just it's not going to be just entertainment, obviously, and but it's going to be everything.
I think VR is kind of the ultimate ephemeralization, right? This is really where
absolutely.
You turn stuff into digits. I mean, it's the end game. When we are, you know, just wholesale replacing real world experiences with digital experiences, which we've been doing all along, but this is taking it up a notch in a big way. we're talking about the truly ephemeral world. So there it is. That's a good breakdown on ephemeralization. What's interesting about this, I'll just mention this since we're at the end of our time. Stephen, you gave me all these topics. You didn't say, hey, this is a show about ephemeralization, but the paradigm actually worked pretty well, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think the two big drivers here that would cover all of these topics are ephemeralization and distribution. Decentralization.
Think Bucky would have said decentralization is just another way to ephemeralize, right? I think that's it's just another way to do more with less, right?
Although you could argue that this going to Mars is a collectivization. So I don't know. I guess you could cut the knife could cut both ways in our favor. So.
We're starting to swim some very deep waters at this point. So at this point, I think we have to say, what's our music?
Our music tonight is There You Are by Zwieback.
Zwieback with There You Are. Thank you, Stephen, for putting that together and for getting such a great list of topics for us this evening. Thank you all for being with us. We will be back again next Sunday evening with an all-new show. And until next time, live to see it.